Right. Welcome everybody to this episode 145 of Extinctionati. So we are almost at the double of the number of episodes, or at least the number of weeks that we had with our founder, Lord Yu. But back in those days, we had two episodes per week, one for the eastern part of the planet and one for the western part of the planet. So they ran higher episode numbers, but we have got almost the same amount of weeks. So for this episode, we are going to try to say something or explore some ideas about it's kind of a complex issue. It's like, if you have, from the deep ecology basis, a concern for other species like plants and animals and insects and fish in the sea and birds in the sky and everything, then obviously this industrial civilization is not the best option, because it's sort of grinding them down into extinction, and there is a hope for a better world after this one collapses. But then you hear people talk about, for instance, that the climate panel, the IPCC, is being ruled by, unofficially ruled by economists, and sort of big oil, and basically ruled by people who don't have climate solutions or climate science at heart or in their minds, and that these people are sort of working for the status quo. And in a sense, to cut the long story short, they are working the IPCC towards a faster collapse of society, of civilization. And also you have some similar things about how the European Green New Deal and the American Green New Deal, critics of them, those political deals, are saying that with all the kind of mining and all the fossil fuels you will have to use in order to extract this this new energy materials and technologies, and even to restart a windmill after it stops, you need to go up using a helicopter to start the blades rotating, all kinds of things that that you need fossil fuels for, even in the green energy economy, and also all the kinds of mining and nature destruction that goes with the new energy economy, plus the fact that you continue to have a growth economic growth economy. So bottom line, all of these things about the sort of so-called Green New Deal, people say that will cause a faster collapse. So then the question for us, as what Lord Yu called deep doomers, the question for us then is that should we support big oil, you know, for sabotaging behind the scenes the climate panel? And should we support Justin Trudeau and WEF and Colonel Biden in the White House when he is launching us into a Green New Deal industrial fairy tale, which we know won't solve the kind of situation or the problem, but because it would collapse this society faster. So it's kind of a big ask and a big question. And we can just start nudging at it, I guess. Maybe it needs to go over several weeks or months, I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of choosing between having a clear conscience and only supporting the really good things on the other on the one hand, and on the other hand, thinking about consequences and getting to kind of the only real solution or a great reset, quote unquote, which is the collapse of civilization and setting things to start again and allowing the forests to grow back and allowing insects to come back and allowing oceans to deplastify, to lose the plastic and recover. That's about it.
And just to add to what you were saying about this whole Green New Deal, and yeah, it's a big question, but I just wanted to add something, another add on to what you were just describing, is how the green, like you hear about AOC, who's the spokesperson for the Green New Deal here in the US. I mean, like she's one of the main cheerleaders. And she recently, she It was reported that she was in her district or her the area that she represents, she was helping the military recruit young people or to their to the military here in the US. And this is something that these are going to poor communities that she represents. And it's just it just doesn't make sense. And also I hear in Germany the Green Party, they are the ones, they've been supporting sending money to Ukraine. And so it's just it's weird how they're pro-war and then they're green, green. It just doesn't make sense. I don't know if you've heard the same thing.
Yeah, it's just insane. It's just insane. And I've been a member of the Green Party in Norway ever since it got started, back in the 1980s. And I've never been so disappointed at any one political party. And I just think it's a part of their DNA, I think, to be these sock puppets for the Pentagon or whatever. I don't know what's the real problem, basically. But yeah, I think they're kind of symbolic of the total fucked upness of this whole system. I think there are so many factors of corruption and so many avenues of corrupting people and making people insane, and it just has to go. That's kind of my solution to everything. Everything just has to go because you can't really fix stupid. I don't think that's possible.
Yeah, and then also to add that I think this whole Green New Deal is sort of a way that those in power can show that they have everything under control. You know what I mean? Because the extreme weather is getting worse, and they have to make themselves look like they're in control when they know the situation is uncontrollable. You know what I mean? And also, it's another way of hiding the energy crisis because politicians can't be honest with their constituents on the fact that we have run out of the cheap fossil fuels that has been running this civilization for the last, for a very long time. Now we have to dig deeper for it, or we have to ship it, like coal. Coal has to be shipped now from area to area, and that adds cost. So, the way Gail Torberg, she writes about this in a very easy to follow, where the price for producers has to be high enough. And then on the side of consumers, it has to be low enough there has to be like a happy agreement on price, or it just won't work, you know? And, so yeah, I think that the government, you know, those in power are just doing whatever they can in desperation, you know, to show that they have this, all of this under control. But things are just falling, you know, now things are just becoming, people are starting to question a lot of, you know, this. So they have to manage all the panic, you know, you know, that might result. And then if you look at what's going on in France, they have woken up to the fact that they're screwed. You know what I mean? And, but I don't know if they understand quite the energy crisis, you know, and that's what's going on, is that we've run out. And so a lot of the privileges that especially people in the West have had are going to go away. So I know Macron tried to talk to, he, in a speech, he said the age of abundance is over last year. However, I was surprised that he actually said that to his people, to the French people.
I think it's very clear to see. I think you have a very good point about the peak oil is really sort of the reality of this so-called Green New Deal. So it's kind of a cover-up, you know, they call it green and ecological and sustainable. It's kind of a cover-up of the fact that we've been running out of oil and gas for the past 20, 30 years, or maybe since the energy crisis in the 1970s, right? So now we're coming to a crunch, and we have peaked in oil production, and we're heading for the long or maybe short downhill slope on the other side. And I think it's also very easy to see. I've been following corrupt or lying Norwegian politicians for the better part of my life, and you can very easily see and, you know, hear and sense whether a particular politician has any regard for life or nature or ecology at all. And most of them, if not 100% of them, just fail in that regard. So when you see these people, when you see Sandy in New York, AOC, her name was Sandy when she went to college, right? When you see Sandy in New York, and you see Biden in the White House, you don't see a burning, raging ecologist. What you see is a A4 standard politician who just wants to, you know, further the industrial adventure, further the industrial fairy tale into the future, and he wants a growth economy to just go on and on and on. And that's why they are using a covert agenda. They say they want a Green New Deal, they say they want everything to be sustainable, but all of these terms have been perverted and abused, just like in Huxley and Orwell's books. So it's like, if they say sustainable, it actually means ecological devastation. It's the opposite of what they say, right? So I think one of the very first counter arguments for jumping their train and to sort of go for deep doomers to go all in with the Green New Deal just because it collapses things faster, we need a kind of an asterisk there, because what we don't want is for things like Thacker Pass and other prospective mining areas to be destroyed for all eternity, to be destroyed for the wildlife and for the natives and everybody in some kind of search for an ecological holy grail with making batteries for electric cars. So I think it still goes that we need to, the movement needs to protect those areas that are kind of blinked out for destruction. I think that still goes. But I guess if the forces of ecological destruction, aka sustainability, which they call it themselves, if they want to go down a road which will fail and which will bring on a faster collapse, we should sort of generally let them do that if they want to do that, because it's kind of like when they, or at least some sort of covert state forces, are attacking energy infrastructure for whatever the reason they're doing that. They're kind of doing the job that the extreme eco activists would do in the 1980s and 1990s, blowing up pipelines and stuff. You know, so if they have some kind of strange, mysterious plan, which in effect ends up with collapsing civilization, in general, we should let them, but we should also protect the rivers and the forests, I think, locally, you know, in the areas that we live and that we know about, have blockades, or, you know, just get the machines out of there. That's kind of my first counter argument there.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much, you know, what I'm doing is I'm just letting it all collapse and helping, like, you know, I volunteer at the local shelter and just getting, you know, we have a community that's just getting stronger and stronger. My other fellow volunteers really, you know, because when you're at a shelter, it's like the front lines of what's, you know, of the collapse that's happening. And also I see, you know, the homeless situation here is getting worse and worse. Just overall in the US, the income disparity is just much, much worse than in Europe, you know? And we don't have the social safety net that you guys have. But I'm, you know, it's crumbling over there too. However, you at least had something to start with. You know, we don't. And so just building community, you know, finding people with similar values. They don't necessarily have to know what's going on, but, you know, when things start crumbling, or they're already crumbling, but as things get worse, having a community, I mean, I can just tell you, for me at the shelter, having my fellow volunteers, even though we're not talking, you know, they don't know what's coming, it feels really good. It's very grounding, you know? And having, you know, the online communities, you know, it's amazing, because since learning about all of our different predicaments in 2016, I've gotten to know several people on Facebook around the world. And it's like we've known each other now for a couple of years, and it's kind of nice. You know, it's very comforting for me to go on Facebook and see them and see their posts and such, you know. So yeah, it's just basically the system, like, and what you were saying about there's going to definitely be more, what do you call it? What's the word when you try to do things on the internet to blow things up? What is that called? Eco, or no, something terrorism.
I don't know. I'm not really sure what you mean.
Well, like, for example, bringing down. The geopolitical battle is getting pretty fierce now. You know what I mean? Between the East and West. sabotage. So they're going to do, there's just and that's going to, because that's, you know, having what, you know, what's going on in Ukraine, that's a very expensive form of, you know, we don't have enough energy for those kind of wars. You know what I mean? For on the ground battles like it's happening. I mean, so a lot of the warfare is going to be cyber warfare, because that's a lot more, you know, cost effective.
Yeah.
So just going after, you know, food, going after energy, that's bringing those things down, is a way to, because we, for us, this is, for the West, this is an existential threat. We want to control Russia because of their oil and, you know, mostly their resources, but in particularly oil. And, you know, we've always wanted to topple the government and being, you know, being control of that area. So, you know, people say, well, no, it's because the military industrial complex makes more money, blah, 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 which, yeah, there's some truth to that, but military industrial complex, is my understanding, they make more money, like in wars where we really overpower the, you know, like we have been fighting these wars in the Middle East where we really overpower the countries we go into. But this is a war which is much more costly when we fight against another country that is militarily wise is more equal to us, you know what I mean? Or even the Russians are even superior. So it's very costly. So for us, this is not, so the military industrial complex doesn't make a lot of money on these kind of wars. This is what they're finding out. There's some studies that came out. You know, I can offer you a reference. What was I saying? Oh yeah. So there's going to be, so the economic warfare is really like the de-dollarization. That's really happening quickly where, you know, the warfare is happening in not so much in like the traditional wars we've seen in the past, but we are definitely at pre-World War I, pre-World War II. I think World War II was an extension of World War I. So we're kind of in that period, you know what I mean? A big geopolitical change. And yeah, also exasperated by the climate. I mean, the climate is just, is really getting, the extreme weather is getting out of control and it's just being so destructive to, in, you know, we're just double, triple whammies all the time. You know what I mean?
I think this week we got the first news about the grain, the agricultural produce from Ukraine being contaminated because Poland didn't really want to buy it because it's so contaminated with all kinds of chemicals from the warfare. Depleted uranium America is using as well, you know, down there. So you don't want to feed your kids with the uranium because that's generally not a good idea. I don't think even Fauci would say that was a good idea to feed your kids, right?
Are you saying that they're really, the West has really been using depleted uranium?
Of course.
Wow.
Everything that is fun is used in war. That's the point of war is that there is no rules and, you know, you throw everything you have at it.
That's a sign that the West is getting very desperate. If they're starting to do that kind of thing, that is a sign that the West is very desperate.
Yeah. So Poland and Hungary and I think Romania, they didn't want to buy grain from Ukraine. And, you know, we talked last week about Ukraine being the big corn chamber or breadbasket of Europe. And it kind of seems to be a part of the plan, you know, to do, just grind things down and make everything more scarce and more expensive. you know, I don't really know what is the chicken and the egg in this case, but you know, when you have all of these things together with the El Nino, which was gonna come somewhere down the line anyway, it kind of seems like a, you know, a stupidity collapse or a controlled planned collapse. I don't know, but it's kind of a political collapse that was unnecessary. But when you add real world collapse, like a kind of short term heating, like the El Nino is, which ends up at a higher level, then you really get to feel a taste of what the main part of collapse will look like, right? And the people will.
Yeah.
Go hungry in Paris and Brussels and Washington and London because of it. So yeah.
It's great. I mean, I'm hearing that inflation in Europe is 10% higher than here in the US. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it is Europe is much more energy deprived, especially, well, I'm talking about like the NATO countries, like the Western, they're really, I just, you know, it, the whole thing there's just so many unknowns right now. And I think the answers will come, you know, little bit by little bit, you know what I mean? The same with climate, you know, we just had this triple dip La Nina and, you know, and then all of a sudden we have all this ice melting in Antarctica, which has been kind of dormant until the last 2 years. So, and then, you know, you hear about the models not modeling very well, the ice sheet melt, you know, the IPCC's models not really covering that very well. So, and you know, this triple dip La Nina wasn't expected, you know, the models were expecting more El Ninos. So it's just, we just have to be comfortable with just, you know, just looking at things day by day, you know what I mean? I mean, changes are happening so fast, but it's sort of like being comfortable, just kind of like with climate, I don't look past 6 months. I try to just focus on the net, you know, today and the next 6 months. And the same, you know, the same with geopolitically what's happening with, you know, civilization, the same thing, just this requires a lot of patience, you know, and just not being afraid, just kind of, kind of taking it in and, you know, what you don't think is going to happen is going to happen. This is what I'm starting to.
I think you can liken it to, if you're in the cottage in the mountains and it's like April, May, right? You have some pieces of snow, some let's say half a meter of snow or something left on your stone deck outside of your cabin, right? And it melts more and more every day, and because it's the spring and the sun is hitting it. And you can kind of have a, if you watch it, you can kind of have a general impression that, yeah, like in 1 or 2 weeks, all of the snow on the deck will be gone by itself, melting. And you can see sort of it progressing day by day. But maybe on day number 8, you have a fresh snowfall overnight, right? So then you get some more snow. But that's kind of what you expect in April. And it's complex, and you cannot really know exactly what day all of the snow on every side of your cottage will be gone. But you're sort of in the ballpark if you say 2 or 3 weeks, right, for that specific situation. So it's kind of, you know, it's not... Even if you have the snowfall on day 8 after Easter, it doesn't mean that winter is back or it's you know, the seasons are turned upside down. It just means, you know, that you have this kind of randomness in the weather. Yeah, so I think we are getting back very fast to rapid warming, and the oceans are warming faster, even faster than the air. In many ways, what we're talking about with El Niños is that the air, or the, you know, the land world where we live, where humans live, over the ocean surface, gets to borrow some of that heat that was in the deep anyway, right? So it's kind of like a bank. We have lots of heat in the bank, and we can only withdraw it when there is an El Niño, kind of. So we really get to feel some of how much warming has been caused already when we get the El Niño.
Yeah. Just to add something with what you were saying, even if we're in neutral, Enzo neutral, because the Earth energy imbalance is very high right now. Earth energy imbalance pretty much represents, you know, where the heat is stored. And most of it, over 90%, is stored in the oceans. And then the remainder, you know, is kind of broken down by air and ice and a few other things or whatever. So basically, the Earth energy imbalance is very high right now. I think from Hansen's latest update, I think it's about almost, it's like 1.1 watt per meter square. It could be even higher than that. One and 1.6, I believe. The satellites have gotten really good at measuring this, and they calibrate it with the ocean data that comes out with the Argo floats. So they calibrate it, and they're finding that the satellite data is pretty reliable. So I think it's actually between 1 and 1.6. It goes up and down, but it's been you know, just getting higher and higher, you know what I mean? And so even a little, if we're in end zone neutral and we have a little futz of an El Nino, just something little, that is still a problem, you know, it'll heat up. So we are safer in La Niñas. I mean, when I say safer, it's still pretty bad, but at least the worry, and I, you know, you've been following the Arctic very closely. The worry is that, and I saw a paper about this, that ENSOs affect sea ice extent in the Arctic. So, for example, I think I saw one of your posts showing the volume of sea ice from currently or a month ago or whatever, and it's very high. And I think that has to do with this, the after effect of this triple dip La Niña, correct?
Well, I don't really know, but the fact is, you know, I like to start with the facts because, you know, one can think about different ways to analyze the facts. But the facts right now is that probably in the week starting today, next week in Europe, we are going to have a peak ice volume for the Arctic sea ice volume. And the only competitor, you know, the only year that is close to this one is actually 10 years ago, exactly 10 years ago. So it's like, will 2013 be higher or lower than 2023? We don't know. So we're kind of at a 10 years ago level of ice, which is a lot because, you know, it does go down. It does go down, even though people go around saying there's a pause to global warming. No, it's never been a false to global warming. Yeah, so we know that it's going to take a hit from the El Nino that is going on now, but maybe the biggest effects of that will only show like next autumn, winter, and even more next spring, because you know there is a lag to these things, and it doesn't. We don't even have El Niño conditions yet in South America, right? So it takes some time before the effects travel up to the Arctic. But I think the main thing here is you get this usually distorted news. You know, the narrative that the news media is telling about what are the dangers about this El Niño, blah 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 blah. Then they're talking about this silly 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees things that are only politically set sort of lines in the sand, and they have practically no meaning. You know, the only meaning of exceeding those artificial limits is that then everybody can see that the planning or the follow up of the agreement and stuff was just a big failure, a big massive failure. But what sort of the IPCC and the UN and the media in general has been deceiving us about for the past 20 years or so, when it comes to the climate and warming of this and this amount of degrees, is that those limits that everybody heard about, 1.5, 2 degrees, they are only sort of agreed upon, negotiated result of politicians talking to each other. So it has no basis in limits and tipping points and points of no return. So they want everybody to focus on the war in Ukraine, obviously, but on the 1.5C, 2.0C, while not telling anybody about the 0.5C, maybe, you know, the limit that we absolutely shouldn't have crossed 30, 40 years ago, right? So yeah. Everybody is supposed to sort of think, oh yeah, the politicians are in control. Oh, Biden is such a wise sage of a man. You know, he really understands this ecology stuff, right? So nothing can be further from the truth. And the Green Party is, you know, all over the place, trying to win some kind of stupid contest, or I don't know.
Yeah.
So they are totally, you know, walking around blind, and they want us to be blind as well, you know, by deceiving us and covering up what they're doing about the peak oil thing by sort of launching some kind of green revolution. So it's like, without information and knowledge and concepts and words that mean something, it's very hard for the population at large to think and talk about things, because mm-hmm. every word means something else than what you think. And it's kind of a total Orwellian system that we have built here. So I'm pretty hopeful that it can collapse and we can, you know, start something new.
That's, I mean, it, you know, just from what I'm observing, I mean, that it just seems to be, especially for some of the complex, you know, the West is has a very complex economy. So the West is the one, you know, we're the biggest contributors to, we have the largest footprint, and we are the most vulnerable right now for this collapse, because you know, we tend to be more service economies, and we rely on the poorer countries to ship us goods, you know, and as you know, as we go deeper into this energy crisis and trade, you know, obviously trade, global trade is, you know, there's needs a lot of cheap fossil fuels. That's part of the complexity that we have set up. And, you know, that's, as that diminishes, then, you know, we're going to be much poorer because we're not going to have all these goods coming in, you know. And then we really need to start talking about global losing the aerosols, but that's for another conversation. But I want to get back to the part about the what you were talking about, the gas temperature, GAST, it's the surface temperature, surface at the over the ocean, surface over the land. That's like you said, that's very, it can be very, it's not a very reliable way, you know, it's not reliable to use that for making climate goals, you know, like this 1.5, because it's much more reliable is using ocean data, because ocean, there's not a lot of interference. Like when you look at taking air temperatures, there's a lot of noise in the air. So I believe you have to take at least 15 to 20 years to spot, like for it to be reliable and spot a trend. While with
the WMO, World Meteorological Organization, they use 30 year normals. And that's, that is specifically in order to see climatic trends.
Right.
So even before climate change was a thing, for over 100 years, they've used 30-year normals, because that is what you need in order to remove the randomness that is
exactly
inherent to the system. So to see if it gets wetter or warmer, you don't want a random 2-year streak of heavy rain to sort of influence that. That trend, you want to take the average of these 30 years and compare to these 30 years, right?
Yeah, that's why taking the ocean is much more stable. I think with ocean, all you need is 4 or 5 years. I mean, ocean is only, you only need, I was reading, there's a really good paper by Liling Cheng and by Trenberth. He worked at NOAA and then left. He left during the Trump administration. He went back to his home country of New Zealand, and he has been working with his Chinese oceanographer, and they've been writing some really good, great papers on Earth energy imbalance. And so he was explaining in one of these papers that the oceans only require 4 or 5 years because they're much more stable and much less noise. And then the second best way after ocean heat content, the second best way, reliable measurement is sea level rise.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. 40% of sea level, around 40% of sea level rise comes from, heat expansion.
Yeah.
Of the ocean.
Yeah. I'm using sea level rise or millimeters. Actually for Antarctica and Greenland, you know, because everybody knows, at least in Europe or outside America, everybody knows what a meter and a millimeter is, right? And everybody knows what a centimeter or a millimeter means at their, you know, at their beach or at their boat or whatever. Yeah. But people don't know what a cubic ton of ice far away is. You know, people have no, you know, concept of that amount of ice. Maybe they have some ice cubes in their refrigerator, but so using sort of you know, to explain how much it melts in Antarctica and Greenland, I think using millimeter sea level equivalent is a good way, because that's sort of hands-on. It's something you can touch and feel in a way. So I would like to present to you a little illustration that I made during the week. Let's see if I can get that up from the other gadget. So, can you see this? I would like you to comment if you have any, you know, kind of comment to what we are seeing here. The idea here was to sort of to open up the field of the collapsing world that we are living in order to see the different sort of aspects of it. Therefore we have civilization is one thing that is crashing, and potentially the biosphere might also go down the drain if we can't you know, avoid it. And you also have concepts like collapse and extinction. You know, Extinction Rebellion is named after extinction, and Extinctionati is named after Extinction Rebellion, ironically. So these are sort of four words or concepts that are talked about a lot in the climate and the doomer community. And I think, you know, putting them up here on sort of an x-axis and a y-axis, it opens up for the opportunity to see the differences and you know, kind of tell stories about what is going on.
Yeah, no, I think this is great, you know, because like I described to you before, my brain is very scattered, so this really organizes. And you know, before I was very much I was feeling that kind of going with the thinking that, you know, humans were going to go extinct in the very near future up until we had this triple dip La Nina. And then I found out that ice sheets weren't being factored in to the IPCC models. And also, you know, just reading Hansen's book about ice inertia. So I was kind of in that sort of thinking. And, you know, whatever happens, I'm okay with whatever outcome. I'm not, you know, I'm not attached to any outcome. I just want to keep a very clear head, you know, in when you're attached to a certain outcome, you cannot keep a clear head very well. You know what I mean? I'm starting to really realize that the Earth is very complex, you know, and yeah, it's incredibly complex. The more I read, the more I realize, wow, you know, this is, it's going to be interesting to see. Hopefully we'll get to, you know, be connected to the internet and get to see, kind of track it as long as we can. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. What's happening now? It's kind of blinking. Okay. Yeah. I think one of the things, you know, if you read this different UN threat reports about climate and stuff, or the broader ecological outlook, I think one of the, why is it doing this? Yeah, one of the things that they kind of forget to inform us about is that the biosphere is threatened by everything humans are doing, you know, if they're building new roads, new airports, new cities even, and sprawl, urban sprawl, there is always kind of a threat factor from what the human activity. And at the same time, we have civilization on the left on this this figure, that is also threatened. Even in the mainstream press, you can see that civilization might not get through this. And the crucial part for the biosphere is that at the moment the civilization collapses, or perhaps, you know, 10, 20 years after, all the stresses, all the other stresses from civilization, apart from the climate, which is sort of a runaway train, which is going anyway, you know, whether we stop it or not, whether we stop emissions or not. But all the other stressors from civilization, they stop when civilization goes away. So I think a lot of thinkers and some early prominent doomers, they seem to forget about the relief for the biosphere that is implied in civilization crashing. So I think that is a major point, because for the billions of species that are not called human beings, they've kind of been living in the shadows, more or less literally, up until now, and they will, you know, have their day in the sun, or have their millenniums in the sun after civilization goes. So that is one way that collapse is opposite from extinction, you know, on the y-axis here, because if you can have a preventative collapse, like take away the sort of toxic bit here, which is civilization, then you can actually work against extinction of the biggest number of species. So it's kind of one collapse of one political system within one of the species, which seems like a kind of a small price to pay to preserve life on Earth in all of the its millions of forms. So that's kind of one of my
you know, I was you know in our Facebook support group, the Extinctionati, I posted something about this graph. It's a revised graph by Bova and colleagues on when the start of modern agriculture about 7,000 years ago, and obviously we're leaving that. A lot of the reason why we were able to develop civilizations is because sea level was very stable, you know, incredibly stable. About 7,000 years ago is when modern agriculture started. So basically we're leaving. We've already left. I mean, if you look at greenhouse gas levels and a sea level rise, we're leaving that area. So, you know, if humans do survive, there's, you know, it's better that there's the least amount of humans as possible, if you know what I mean, for the rest of life, you know.
I think that goes without saying that if you ask the badgers and the bats and the sheep and whatever, and the fishes, they would like us to be a little bit less sizey, a little right. bit less multiplous. So that's kind of a slam dunk. Seeing it from an ethical and human point of view is something very different, and that's what everybody has been taught at school and university, that humans are the only thing that matters, you know. So you cannot be you cannot be cruel to humans, and we need to multiply and we need to increase the tax basis. Yeah, but that's kind of your point of view. That's kind of your specific little point of view there, seeing everything from your and the human perspective. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, and also the thought of death is terrifying to people. I mean, I've looked at, I think I've been very just shocked by self-delusion in humans. I mean, I was so I finally found the work of Sheldon Solomon, Ernest Becker, and also Danny Brouwer and Ajit Varghese, that they wrote a book called Denial, and just the mechanisms they go through the evolutionary process of the human brain and how it developed, and how easily we delude ourselves. We grab on, if we don't like something, we just grab onto delusion. I mean, that's how we're wired. And I think for the humans that survive, that would likely be bred out. There will be much less delusional just for survival purposes. I think the kind of delusion, maybe the genetics that have dominated in these last thousands of years among humans has been more delusional, just because civilization rewards that, it rewards psychopathy, it rewards delusion, and so I think probably hunter-gatherers had a lot less of that for survival purposes. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
So,
I think like native Inuit culture, for instance, in northern Greenland, they reward sharing, so they reward the opposite. They always reward sharing. So some seal hunter comes back with his dog sled, having caught a seal or three. Even before he gets inside his house, the seals are shared with the different families living in the village, right? So even before the blood has dried or run off it or frozen, maybe it's been shared to the other people there, so that. And that's the same, when some of the people from some of the hunters from the other houses go out and come back, right? Then that is shared down near the ice, near the village, to all the families. And that's just how it works, because everybody's gotta eat, and they've been living like this for thousands of years. So when you don't have sort of the supermarket and all of the things that we take for granted, it m works much better to just share what you have caught, the berries you picked, the fish you got, the hunt, the meat you got, share it, and that's the way the others survive and you catch it, and that's why how you survive when you're hurt or whatever, you can't hunt, or when you're not hunting anyway, you get food. And so that's kind of a collective, small group or a tribal way of surviving, to share the stuff that you have.
I mean, and definitely, like if you look at the qualities, the psychopathic qualities, those pass on, because women will be much more attracted to, women are looking for resources, and people who in civilization, those that hoard the resources, females will want to go for those men. You know what I mean? So those genes will be passed on.
Don't get me started on that.
And in a hunter gatherer and in a hunter gatherer society, everyone is held accountable. And so like they have to be very careful with people, like even psychopaths. I mean, you know, it's interesting, all the research done on psychopathy, it's about 1% of the population I've heard in like the US. I don't know the rest of the world, but I've heard it's roughly 1%. Hunter gatherers can't afford to have psychopaths in their tribes. So that's how they probably have bred them out. You know, I haven't seen the exact research on this. Maybe you have, where, I mean, you can already, maybe accidental killings killings that were not so accidental, you know, out on hunts. I mean, maybe that's the way they got rid of them, because it's for survival. You know what I mean? While a psychopath can do very well